We are in Revelation chapter 20. Last class period, we talked about Revelation chapter 19, 11 through 21, the second coming of Jesus. We talked about, at the end of class, the difficulties of the progression and the recapitulation options for moving into chapter 20. I told you that even though I felt like the evidence, you know, so I can see it from both angles. To me, it makes much more sense to land on recapitulation. And the primary reason why, number one, is that the rest of the Bible does it, so it shouldn't surprise us. Number two, Revelation does it quite a lot, shouldn't surprise us. Chi Adon doesn't refer to a chronological sequence in Revelation. It refers to a visionary sequence, which is a much different statement. And there was a fourth reason, but I don't remember why. What do we do with all the nations that were wiped out that Satan now has to deceive in Revelation chapter 20, verse 3? The narrative itself doesn't seem to make sense if they're going progression. Therefore, we can either develop a theological system and try to force it in anyway, or we can allow the text to be the text and just allow the text to function the way it functions. And accept the fact that maybe John, a Jewish writer, is not writing like a Western mind thinks. That shouldn't be novel to us. It should be something that we realize that even though we think linearly, they don't. And either we can be upset or ignore the way they think, or we can actually pay attention to it so we can actually hear what they're saying. But you know what? You take the Bible out of context, you can make it say whatever you want. Right? Awesome. So these next 10 verses is where the crux of all the millennial debates occur. The next seven verses, the first half of the seventh verse also mentions it, is the only where in the entire Bible where we have any concept of a 1,000-year reign ever. And we can develop entire theological systems based off of these seven verses and try to make them dictate the way the rest of the Bible reads. That's dangerous. Always. Always dangerous. Nowhere else in the rest of the Bible do we have a mention of a 1,000-year reign at any point. Therefore, I think it'd give me pause to develop an entire theological system that revolves around this concept of a 1,000-year reign whenever it wasn't important enough ever to be talked about before 95, 96. That, to me, would give me pause. But for other people, it doesn't, so we still need to deal with the issue. Verse 1. What we're going to see in the first three verses is a lot of symbols coming to play, and we have to ask the question, how are the symbols functioning together, and what is the picture that is being painted? Otherwise, we are not going to understand what John is communicating. There are going to be different words that we're going to want to interpret, because we think we know what they mean. But my challenge would be to allow the text to speak. Before you assume you know what even one word means in these next three verses, ask how is it functioning in the rest of the book? How does the word function even just regular day language? And we'll get to that in just a minute. But it says in 20 verse 1, "And I saw an angel coming down out of heaven, having the key to the abyss and holding in his hand a great chain." Okay, first of all, what does the concept of a key and the concept of a chain communicate symbolically? What is it communicating? Now, why would I say, let me back up 1 second. I agree with your answer, but let me back up 1 second. Why would I even say symbolically? Maybe it's not really a symbol. Maybe he really is going to use the key and the chain for something. However, I will say this. If you're going after Satan, who doesn't seem to always be a material being, it's kind of weird if we're not talking symbolic language for a chain and a key being used against an immaterial being with material things. Odd. So maybe we should just let the image be the image and just say, okay, something symbolically is happening here. What is it describing? Authority. The key and the chain combined together to show great authority. Where is the key first used in the book of Revelation? Chapter 1, verse 18. Exactly right. When Jesus says, "I once was dead, but now I am alive, and I live forever and ever, I now hold the key to death and Hades." What did we talk about as the key being used? It's used 4 times in Revelation. Revelation chapter 1, verse 18. Revelation chapter 9, verse 1. I missed one. Revelation chapter 3, verse 2? 12? The key of David is the one I'm referring to. You can find it up and tell me. Chapter 3, 7. Ah. Chapter 3, verse 7. Chapter 9, verse 1, and here in Revelation chapter 20, verse 1. We talked about in symbols. Whenever a symbol is in the immediate context, it doesn't help us interpret the symbol. We move second to the book context, right? In the book context, the very first time the key is used as a symbol in 1:18, it is referring to the authority and the sovereignty that Jesus has over death that was accomplished at what time? The resurrection. Therefore, I believe, actually, I wouldn't even just say the resurrection, I would say the Christ event. Because at that point, what I can do is I can say this. The Christ event, His birth to the resurrection. Christ event. More accurate. Because what we're going to see is that Jesus was actually warring and gaining the authority all, even the moment He was born, there was a war in heaven and something happened quite significant there. So, the Christ event is the moment whenever Jesus was accomplishing or attaining or establishing the authority, securing the sovereignty over all of death, which was ultimately accomplished at the resurrection. I believe at that point, that symbol, the way it's used the first time and throughout the rest of Revelation, is giving us somewhat of a time indicator of when this binding could be occurring. When? At the Christ event that was ultimately accomplished in the resurrection. That it's saying that what is happening now is beginning with the ministry of Jesus. And it will end in verse 10. Now, could I be stretching that far? Maybe. But the things that start to add up in the moments that come by, you will see that the case starts to begin to be built. It's not only built off the word key. It's built off of the New Testament theology of Satan's interaction with Jesus throughout His ministry. So, what we can say at best, though, is that the key is attached to the sovereignty Jesus attained at the Christ event. That's the first time the way in which the key was used. And combined with the chain, it's showing great authority that this angel has over that which he is approaching. For at this point, we don't even know it's the dragon until verse 2. Right? He seized the dragon, that ancient serpent who is the devil or Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. What does that remind you of? He sees the dragon, that ancient serpent, the devil, who leads the whole world astray. What is that from? Chapter 12. What happened in chapter 12? That's the same language that's used there, correct?
Yeah.
What was chapter 12 about? Help me. What is chapter 12 describing? What story?
The birth of Jesus.
The birth of Jesus and His ascension, in which Satan fights a war and was hurled down to earth. And in verse 9 it says, the dragon was hurled down, Satan, the ancient serpent, who leads the whole world astray. Linguistic parallel also maybe helped me indicate the fact that John may be recapitulating the same event. Is that illogical? If he's using the same authority of Jesus that was accomplished at the Christ event that's talked about in chapter 12, and the same language describing Satan is used again in chapter 20, does that not maybe suggest that he's describing the same event from a different perspective for a different purpose? What I would argue is that chapter 20 begins before chapter 19, 11 through 21, if I'm putting it on a timeline. Chapter 19, 11 through 21 is the second coming of Jesus, but chapter 20 seems to start back here at the first coming of Jesus. And it's going to take us to the end where this one eventually gets us, but it kind of takes a couple of steps back and makes a running start at it. He seized the dragon, the ancient serpent, and bound him for 1,000 years. Several things in this. Number one, the great chain, the word that is used there is elusis. And it is actually used to describe manacles or fetters that are used on people's wrists and sometimes even attached to their legs. That's the image. It's not just this great chain that he wraps him up with and then ties a knot and puts a lock on it. It's manacles, it's fetters. It's whenever Peter is in the prison and it says the chains, the elusis, fell off of his hands. Same word. The fetters, the manacles. Second thing, the word bind there is quite significant. Because where else in the Bible, in the New Testament, do we find this same word bind in connection with of the kingdom of Satan being onslaughted by Jesus' kingdom? Binding the strong man in Mark chapter 3 and Matthew chapter 12. Jesus says, no, wait a minute. They come and they say, you're casting out Satan by Satan, because you're possessed by Satan. He says, now how could Satan be casting out Satan? That's stupid. He says, a kingdom divided would fall. He says, no. Everything that's happening here, it's like this. If you want to rob a strong man, first thing you need to do is bind him. Same word. Bind him. And then what? Then you're able to plunder his whole home. Everything. How do we bind the strong man? The Christ event seems to be a pretty significant point in which that binding occurs, but we'll talk about that in a minute. Point is, look at the picture he's developing. For 1,000 years, He is going to be bound. Now, I'll ask that question in a bit. He threw him into the abyss and locked and sealed it over him. Why? To keep him from deceiving the nations anymore until the 1,000 years were ended. After that, well, we'll get to that last phrase. Okay, a couple of things that people assume here because they're looking at the language. What's the word I'm going to use that's not a pejorative term? Ignorantly, I'm trying to use that in as nice of a way as I can. A couple of things. Number one, to be bound doesn't mean bound does not equal, we're doing math equations today. Yeah. Does not equal eradication, does it? Did Paul's ministry cease when he was bound and put into a prison?
No.
Really? How could you argue such a thing?
Well, doesn't he say he's in chains, the apostle in chains, and he's ministering to the people in the household that he's being...
Yeah, we know he's converting people around him. What else is Paul doing whenever he's in chains?
Right.
Writing the New Testament. How can we possibly say that binding equals eradication? Their ministry ceases once they're bound. Really? Because we don't even have New Testament evidence of that. Binding means restrained, limited, constrained. The example that William Hendrickson uses, that a lot of people use, is it's like a dog that has a great long chain. Satan never had total free reign, did he? Never total. He didn't have complete sovereignty. He still had to function within the will of God. Satan, though, has a great long chain, especially in the Old Testament. We'll talk about this more in a bit. But in the New Testament, with the Christ event, the chain was greatly restrained or bound or restricted or shortened. However, it doesn't mean that within he describes a dog. He said, picture a dog. If you walk into the circle of a dog, you don't think his ministry can still be carried out? Of course it can. The question is how widespread is his ministry able to be? There is a binding that occurs, but it doesn't equal an eradication. Paul was not able to travel with freedom, and yet he was still able to minister. He wasn't eradicated. Number one, that's the first thing that people just assume, that binding equals eradication. Second thing, when they say, well, he is thrown into the abyss to keep him from deceiving the nations, we assume that we understand what the word deceiving even means. I before E, except after C. Deceiving even means, right? Did I spell it wrong still? Oh, okay, good. We assume what it means. What does the word mean?
Trick.
Trick? What else? That's good, that's right.
Leading astray.
Leading astray. We got to be careful with that language. It is true. The problem is that whenever we define it as leading astray, what do we immediately download into those two words? Salvation language, don't we? And yet, is that what the word deceive means all the time in every context? On April Fool's Day, the day this lecture is occurring, is it not a day of deception? Isn't that the point of jokes and hoaxes like that? It's like this morning, my kids were getting ready for school, and I said, kids, I forgot to tell you, tonight when you get home, we're flying out to Scotland for 3 weeks. And my daughter started jumping up and down, and she was excited, and I said, April Fool's. It was brutal. And she was like, what do you mean? What is that? And I had to explain to them. And my point in telling them that was, I said, people are going to be doing that throughout the day. Know that people are going to be joking a lot today and that you're not deceived. Because I don't want somebody to do that to my kids whenever I haven't done it to them first and it actually hurt them. So what did I do? I was leading them astray, but not salvifically. Was I? And yet we download that into that language, don't we? Here's the question. Does deception with Satan always mean leading people salvifically away? Always. How do we define the word deception? Deception is one of the words that you always have to define it through the intention of the person that is deceiving. That's how it gets its full definition. It has to have a context. In Revelation chapter 12, verse 9, it says, who leads the whole world astray, deceives them to salvifically lead them astray. That's very clear. However, here, what does it say? Deceives the nations. For what purpose? Just to lead them away from Jesus? Here is how we answer that question very simply. We look what happens whenever he is allowed to deceive them in verses 7 through 10. And that defines what the word deceiving means for me then, right? Whenever he is released in verses 7 through 10, he's allowed to deceive the nations. What does he do? Let's read 7 through 10. He gathers them for battle. And what do they go to battle? What do they go to destroy? What do they go to make war against? The church. You see, when we assume that we know what the word deceiving means, it's just to lead people astray, just to trip them up on the salvation path. The problem is, whenever he's allowed to deceive, that's not what he's doing. He's deceiving the nations so he can destroy the church. My argument then is that Satan's deception, what he is kept from, what he's thrown into the abyss, imprisoned, not allowed to do, is to destroy the church. Why? Because that's how the word deceiving functions within the context. We can assume it means salvation, or we can allow the context to tell us what it means through the intention of the one that is actually deceiving. Are you following what I'm saying here? Deception is designed, is defined through intention. My deception this morning with my child is defined not as just me being evil, but of actually trying to prepare them for the day. See what I mean? Or, if I deceived you guys and was just like, hey, you know that whole test talk? April Fools! That's just me being mean. Or me just trying to get a laugh, even though it wasn't very funny. You see what I mean? It's not April Fools, by the way. Your paper's still due on Friday. But you see the point. The way you define deception has to be through the intention of the one deceiving. Otherwise, well, you can make it say whatever you want. Are you tracking with me? When Satan is allowed to deceive, what does he do? What is he kept from doing whenever he's not allowed to deceive? He's kept from destroying the church. Therefore, you've heard preachers preach before, and I've heard preachers preach before, and maybe, I hope you haven't, preached this before, that the church is just one generation away from being extinct. And Revelation 20 says, that is not true. The church can never be extinct. Because that is the one thing Satan is imprisoned from doing. He cannot do that. He cannot accomplish the deception of the nations that leads to the destruction of the church. It's not possible. Why? Because God wouldn't let that happen. You see what I'm saying? You're following with what... If we pull away the theological junk and we start actually really asking what does the text say, all of a sudden it's painting a different picture than this weird millennium that's doing weird stuff. I'm going to argue that John hasn't switched in chapter 20 to start talking about some future time period. I'm going to argue that John's talking in chapter 20 what he's been talking about all throughout Revelation, and that's the time period in which the churches of Asia Minor are existing as well as us. The time period between the first coming and second coming of Christ. Why? Because it seems like the binding of Satan begins at the first coming. We're going to talk about what does the binding mean more in just a minute. But it seems that through the key imagery and through the other ways in which the binding language, and even through the parallel to chapter 12, that the beginning of this is at the Christ event. And yet, this will all end at the destruction of Satan in verse 10, which would be the second coming of Christ. Therefore, I would argue that the first coming and second coming of Christ, the 1,000 years, is the time period of the church, the church age. 1,000 years, first coming and second coming of Christ. How is Satan bound? If I'm going to argue that he is drastically limited because of the Christ event, I'm going to need to actually take seriously, what Jesus did. But what did Jesus do that bound Satan? Help me.
Defeated death.
Yeah, I'm going to put that one as the number one. We've talked about that some right now. We've talked about that some before. He defeated death. That's pretty huge. We'll come back to that. What else did he do? What else are ways in which Satan was bound?
Well, he was cast out of heaven.
Ooh. Chapter 12 says he was cast out of heaven, right? That's huge, isn't it? We may think it's not. And yet, the accuser can no longer go before the king and accuse us? Isn't that what chapter 12 says? Blessed are you, heaven, rejoice! For the accuser of our brothers has been hurled down, never to be allowed to enter again. But woe to you, earth, because he's filled with rage and he knows his time is short. Was he allowed to go and just walk around in heaven in the Old Testament?
Yes.
Yes. Read Job, friends. Right? He had free rein to go between heaven and earth at all times, to where he could actually be trying to poke and prod God to a God to expand his will. Now he doesn't even have the privilege. He's not even allowed in the courtroom. I don't know about you, but if you're in any sort of courtroom and your defense attorney or your defense lawyer that's defending you isn't even allowed in the courtroom, you're at a disadvantage. The jury's probably not going to be in your favor if you're not even allowed a voice. Right? Do you think being cast out of heaven's a big deal? You're darn right it is. Not only that, but for the first time at the Christ event in the history of the world, the mystery of God has been revealed. Atonement stuff, but also God's plan. That's a big deal. Why? Because that means that we can actually open it up to the nations in an unprecedented way. Hence Pentecost and Gentile conversions. It's a big deal. Satan's kingdoms that he's had a death grip on for so long, now all of a sudden are wide open to the gospel because the truth has been unleashed on the earth. And ultimately, that's why I think that this is, number one, the truth is that death has been destroyed. The greatest weapon that Satan can wield, every time he uses it now, it turns back on him. It's the way we win. Does that mean Satan is eradicated? No! Does it mean he is greatly limited or bound? You're darn right! If the Christ event didn't bind or restrain or constrain or limit Satan in some way, then what did Jesus do? If we're still waiting for the effects of Jesus' ministry to occur on the kingdom of Satan, how is that theology that is freeing at all? You know what I mean? If you believe, now listen to this. This is one of my major problems with the whole future kingdom concept. If you believe that 1,000 years isn't happening now, then you're having to suggest that the kingdom of God is not reigning right now. It's in the future. And yet Jesus comes and he says in Matthew chapter 4, verse 17, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is near." No, it's not. No, it's not. I, John, your brother and companion in the suffering, in the kingdom, in the patient endurance. John, kingdom hasn't come yet. Jesus has purchased us with his blood to make us a kingdom and priests. No, he hasn't. That doesn't happen until 1,000 years. There seems to be a lot of oddity throughout the New Testament if the kingdom isn't reigning right now. Why is Jesus described as sitting at the right hand of God? Jesus, you're not allowed to be there yet. That means you're reigning. Why is Daniel 7 constantly being paralleled in the way in which in Daniel 7 he receives a kingdom? Jesus, you can't receive it yet. We got to wait till 1,000 years. Reigning, we think, has to be defined the way we define deceiving. Reigning, if he's not reigning the way we think he should be reigning, then he's not reigning. Wow, who's the king in this situation? Can't he reign the way he desires to reign, even if it means more souls under the altars needs to be killed before he stops their death? Oh, no. It's not reigning. It's clearly Satan is reigning. Really? Well, some people would even argue that the cross wasn't a victory either. But we all know that's not true. Is Satan bound? My question is, at the ministry of Jesus, how can we say he's not bound? As a matter of fact, New Testament's pretty clear on this. Luke chapter 10, verse 18. This is one that I'm listing them in more incipient, and I think they develop throughout my list. After the ministry of the disciples, in which they go out at the commission of Jesus, and they come back, and they're describing to Jesus, they would say, "We were preaching the word. We're casting out demons." Do you think that that's binding of Satan when you're casting out demons? Jesus even says in Matthew chapter 12, "If I cast out demons by the finger of God, then the kingdom of heaven is upon you." 12:28. But he says in Luke 10:18, he says, "Yeah, while you were out there, I saw Satan fall like lightning." In other words, something's affecting the kingdom of Satan drastically by what you're doing. John chapter 12, 30 through 32. After the triumphal entry and Jesus predicts his coming death, a voice from heaven comes to validate Christ's ministry, and Christ then says, "This voice was for your benefit, not mine. Now is the time for the judgment on this world. Now the prince of the world will be driven out." Well, Jesus, no, you didn't accomplish that because he's still reigning. John chapter 16, verse 11, after Jesus tells that he is going to die and going to be with the Father and the Holy Spirit's to come, he says, "The prince of this world now stands condemned." Now he does. Is that not a binding or a limiting? Is Satan's kingdom not drastically changing because of what Jesus is doing? 1 John chapter 3, verse 8 says, "The reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the devil's work." Did he? 1 John says the only reason why Jesus came was to destroy Satan's work. Well, good job you did, Jesus, because there's still wars going on. Didn't do such a good job, Jesus. Maybe the cross wasn't as successful as you think it is, Jesus. So we'll wait for the 1,000 years until you really reign. Mark chapter 3, 27, we've already talked about the binding of the strong man. Colossians 2, 15, "And having disarmed the power and authorities, he made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them by the cross." Oh, I like that passage because it leads into my interpretation of what I think chapter 20 is actually doing. It actually introduces the oddity of the last phrase of verse 3. At this point in verses 1 through 3 of chapter 20, the people are exhilarated in Asia Minor. They're saying, "Darn right, Jesus conquered Satan, we can stand." And then this verse ends in an odd note. After that, he must be set free for a short time. I'm sorry, what? And then he drops the issue for 3 verses. He's like, "Oh yeah, by the way, he's going to be released." The word "must" is the word "day," which in some scholars call the divine necessity. It is willed by God that he must be set free. Hold on, what? You see how the picture is becoming odd? And then John, like all good literary writers, he develops attention and then just says, "Just let that sit for a while. I'll come back to it in a bit." And he comes over here and starts talking about something else. That's what happens in verses 4 through 6. "I saw thrones on which were seated those who had been given authority to judge. And I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded because of their testimony for Jesus and because of the word of God. They had not worshipped the beast or his image and had not received his mark on their foreheads or their hands. They came to life and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. We'll talk about the last 2 verses here in a minute, but I want to ask this question. Where are we? Where are we? First of all, let me ask the question. Where do people assume that we are of the reigning of Jesus and of his saints in 1,000 years? Where do we assume he is?
After.
No, not when. Where? Where is the reign of 1,000 years traditionally established?
Jerusalem,
which would be on earth, right? Here's the question. In verses 4 through 6, is the word "earth" ever used? Ever. Look, help me. Does it ever say that Jesus and his saints are reigning on earth in verses 4 through 6? I see some shaking no. Have everybody read through it? Does it say? No. It doesn't say.
It says they came to life.
Yeah. It says they came to life. It never says where. We just say, well, it's on earth. Why? Because, you know, Satan was bound and he was on earth. And yet, in Revelation chapter 12, 1 through 6, where are we predominantly? Earth, right? The birth of Jesus. Then what happens in verses 7 through 9? We jump up to heaven to have a war, don't we? And then after heaven, what happens? We jump back down to earth and talk about that for a little bit. And then after we talk about earth for a little bit more, what do? We jump up and there's a chorus in it. Is there a hopping back from earth to heaven? Is there a precedent for that in Revelation? Even in a parallel passage to this one? You're darn right. But that doesn't prove anything. Here's the kicker. In the book of Revelation, the word "throne" is huge. Whenever I did my thesis, I basically said that Grant Osborne is one thrown word study away from being an amillennial. One thrown word study. If he would do a thrown word study, he would realize he can't hold the position that he holds. The book of Revelation, the word throne is used 47 times. If I can find where it is in here, I can show you the exact ones. 47 times. Come on, friends. That's why I should pay attention to my notes more. It doesn't matter. It's used 47 times. Three times it is used to not refer to God, Jesus, or one of his saints. Only three times. Help me describe when those three times occur. Throne of Satan in Pergamum. That's one. Where is the throne of Satan in Pergamum? Heaven or earth? Earth. Second time.
Beast.
What's that?
Beast from 13.
Yes, exactly. Where is his throne? Earth. The other time is chapter 16, whenever one of the bowls is poured out on the throne of the beast, which is where? On the earth. Every time the word throne is used in connection with Satan or one of his minions, it is always on earth, which would fit kind of the feel of the book of Revelation, wouldn't it? Hence, the people that follow Satan are also called all the time what? Earth dwellers. The other 43 times, notice I say 43 because I'm not establishing the word throne here in verses 4 through 6 yet. The other 43 times it is used in connection to God, Jesus, or one of his followers, like the 24 elders. And every single time, where are they in the book of Revelation? Outside of 4 through 6, where are they? Heaven. Every time. Therefore, in order for me to make verses 4 through 6 on earth, it would be the only time in the book of Revelation, out of 47 times, that the word throne was connected with Jesus, God, or one of his followers, and it was on earth. The only time. Now, if it said the word earth in 4 through 6, I would buy it. Since it doesn't say the word earth, the word throne is used, attached to Jesus, one of his followers, what would be my logical conclusion of where this reign is actually occurring? Heaven. You see the problem? We assume it's on earth, but we're not paying attention to the way in which the language is developing. So what we do is we put this on earth, we develop this weird thing where there's resurrected bodies and non-resurrected bodies, and they're living for 1,000 years, but at 99 years, some have to die. We develop this weird, psychotic understanding because we're not paying attention to the simple words that are being used. If you've been tracing throne this far, you'd have no question where we're at. But people don't want to know where we're at. They want to just tell me where they're at without even asking. You see what I'm saying? See my difficulty with this? Why? Explain to me why the word throne here is used any differently than any of the rest of the time in the book of Revelation. Or why earth all of a sudden has looked differently than any other time in the book of Revelation. You know the 1,000-year reign? A lot of times they associate the 1,000-year reign, or they apply it, Old Testament passages like Isaiah, where the lion's laying down with the lamb and things of that nature. Have you heard that? Matter of fact, beginning of the 13th book, it talks about how the lion are laying next to the lamb in the millennial kingdom. The oddity of that is those images, Old Testament allusions-wise, really parallel chapter 21 and 22. The new heavens and the new earth. Parallel the allusions. There is not a single allusion to the Isaiah passages in chapters 21 through 10. Not one. And yet we assume from 1,000 years, the only time it's mentioned, that we can just take all those passages and say, well, that's the millennial kingdom. And yet in the millennial kingdom, there's also the existence of brothels, according to the Left Behind series, and pornography, and kidnapping, and even murders. And that's what makes me really odd. It's really strange about it. I'm reading through the 13th book, and I'm going, so what's changed from what I'm living now and what you're describing in the millennial kingdom? I mean, I know you have to have your nations for Satan to deceive. But what's changed? If your millennial kingdom, when Satan is bound, looks like what it still does today, because what is their argument? Well, it's the evil of men's hearts. Then how can I not say the same thing about the current dispensation that we're in? Right? If you're going to argue that Satan bounding means he has to be eradicated, then how come your millennial kingdom looks just like the one I'm living in right now? Got to have the nations to deceive. The point is this, they can't get around it. You read the 13th book, you'd feel like you're just reading a modern day story about today, where people are still caught up in all kinds of sin, even more debauchery than what sometimes you can even stomach. The point is this, let's let the text speak. We assume we understand how to interpret Revelation 21 through 10. We're not even letting it talk. We're just going to force it to say what we want it to say. Why? My system has to have it say this. I saw thrones on which were seated those who had been given authority to judge, and I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded because of their testimony for Jesus and because of the Word of God. They had not worshipped the beast or his image, had not received his mark on their foreheads or their hands. They came to life and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. The rest of the dead did not come to life until the 1,000 years were ended. This is the first resurrection. The word first is a word that they commonly overlook, thinking they know what it means. The word first, the significance of it is not so much a sequence as it is its weight. Where else in the New Testament do we see the word first? In chapter 1, help me.
First and the last.
The first and the last, okay. I mean in the New Testament, let's broaden to the New Testament though. When the word first is used as an adjective describing something else, where else do we see that in the Bible?
Firstborn,
that's actually one word. Think Romans.
First Adam.
First Adam. What's first Adam describing? Yeah, who is the second Adam?
Jesus.
Yeah. Because first belongs to this order of things. What else? The first what? First man? Or what about the first heavens and the first earth? As opposed to the new heavens and the new earth? Or the first order of things? What is first usually consigning things to? The order that is passing away. Right? Wouldn't it be cool if instead of me saying the first time you die, I would look at a Christian and say, oh, that's not your first death. That's your first resurrection. Wouldn't that be cool? Why? Why would that make sense theologically? Because when we die, what are we really doing? We're actually coming to life, baby. Right? And if you're talking to Christians in Asia Minor who are dying, you wouldn't say, this is the first death. And they're like, oh. Wouldn't it make much more sense if you say, this is the first resurrection? What about, let's do this. If the first resurrection is bodily, in the sense of the old order, the body is passed, that's the key thing where a soul is left over. That would also coordinate to what we would call the first death, bodily. The second death, if you notice the emphasis of the second death, whenever we get to that point, the emphasis is going to be on the destruction, the soulless destruction of the person because of their commitment to whatever part of the allegiance they were on. And these two are antithetical. These two are antithetical. The first resurrection and second resurrection are antithetical as well. For this one is a soulish existence and this one will be a bodily one. And yet instead of calling this the second resurrection, which everybody takes part in, he calls it a second death. Because he's wanting to emphasize a particular group of people within the second resurrection. See what he's doing? Instead of calling this the first death, which everybody takes part in, he's calling it the first resurrection because he's trying to emphasize the group that he's speaking to that's within this. And when he talks about the second death, instead of just talking about it as the second resurrection or the resurrection, he doesn't want to give them any sort of positive light onto their existence. He says instead, no, it's not a resurrection for you, it's a death. So what he does is he uses the word first to describe what is going to pass away, because eventually we will have a second resurrection that everybody will occur, but for some it will not be new life and a new body, it will be death. You see what he's doing? He's focusing on the people he's speaking to, and he's trying to speak hope into their lives. And he's saying, for you, when you die, whenever your head is cut off for the testimony of Jesus Christ, whenever people like Antipas are passing around you, whenever you are punished, whenever you hold firm to the faith, even if they kill you, it's a resurrection. And Satan's binding becomes more glaringly obvious. Right? This is the first resurrection. Then comes the sixth beatitude. Blessed and holy are those who have part in the first resurrection. Blessed are those that die in Jesus. The second death has no power over them. Why? Because it's not a second death for us. It's a second resurrection. It's not just our soul that's being translated to heaven. It's now we get a body to go along with it. But they will be priests of God and of Christ and will reign with Him 1,000 years. What does that sound like? Kingdom priests. That even if we die and our souls are translated to heaven, even if we do that, we will be a kingdom priests. If we live on earth, we are a kingdom priest. If we die, we're a kingdom priest. Whenever the new heavens comes, we will be a kingdom priests. Because that's who we are, because that's what Jesus accomplished. Okay, now comes verse 7. First of all, we need to review verses 1 through 3. What happened to Satan in verses 1 through 3? Was there one thing that happened to him or two? Say it again. He was bound. And what else happened to him? Yes, imprisoned. These are two separate realities. Why? Because how can he be released from the first one if it's attached to the Christ event? How are the effects of the resurrection undone for a short time? Isn't that weird? Can the power of death ever be restored to Satan for a short time? No. Can the mystery be recovered for a short time that has now been opened up to all the Gentiles? No. And yet it says he's released. Released from what? From his keeping, from destroying the church. Let the picture develop. Now here we go. When the 1,000 years are over, in that phrase, what just happened? If I define the 1,000 years as the time period between the first coming and the second coming of Christ, and I call this 1,000 years, and it says the 1,000 years are over, what just happened? Jesus just came back in that one little phrase. This is where the amillennials freak out. No one knows what to do with the release of Satan. No one knows what to do. Premillennials, they make up this weird 1,000-year brothel-infested psychosis. Amillennials, G.K. Beale and I have had conversations about this, and him and I just flat-out disagree. Where Beale says, no, what's going to happen is right before Jesus comes back, everything's going to get really, really, really bad. He even says that the entire church will almost be snuffed out, and at the very last minute, God rescues it. And my response back to him is, but what do I do with the first phrase of verse 7? When the 1,000 years are ended. So you're telling me that the snuffing out of almost all the church happens after Jesus comes back? Oh, you know, you're taking it too literal. I mean, he didn't know what to say. This is what I would say. No, everything that happens in verse 7 through 10 is after Jesus comes back. Because there's something bigger to fry than a theological perspective or some psychotic theological agenda that's based off of 2 Thessalonians 2 and not Revelation chapter 20, 7 through 10. Satan is released after the 1,000 years, Satan is released for a specific purpose. Notice at the last half of verse 7, Satan will be released from what? His prison. What is not described? What does it say he's not released from? His binding. Let me give you a history lesson. In Roman times, starting back all the way in 735 BC with Romulus, the supposed founder of Rome, inscribed on the these bronze tablets that go around, that's the fasti, I forgot the last Latin word for it. Anyway, it's in the Forum in Rome. It lists 400 of what's called triumphal processions from 735 BC all the way up to the time of Augustus. 400. Triumphal processions were this. Whenever a general or an emperor, this is before Augustus, whenever a general would make a major victory, he could be granted by the Senate a triumphal procession. And what would happen in the triumphal procession is basically he would have these grand honors bestowed on him as he brings the spoils of war into the city of Rome. And they would make this big, long parade, and they would weave their way up until we'll talk about the climactic moment in a minute. The point of the whole thing, though, was to honor the battle that had been won. Okay? When Augustus came to power, he made a major shift with the triumphal processions. For there was only two people in the time of Augustus' reign that were not a part of the imperial family. that were granted some sort of triumphal procession. From the time of Augustus all the way up through the end of the Roman Empire, triumphal processions were only in honor of the emperor and his family. That's it. Every battle that was won, the general could be awarded a smaller parades, but never a triumphal procession. The way triumphal processions began to develop eventually was, like, for example, Domitian had two triumphal processions. But what they would do is, because they were more limited now, we had 400 within the first 735 years, like one almost every other year. But then after that, we have maybe 40. But what happens is it starts to dominate all the imagery. As a matter of fact, I'm going to show you an altar here in a minute that's very significant. But it starts to dominate all their imagery on their coins and on their altars and on their architecture, triumphal imagery. It's because the triumphal procession emphasizes the climax of honor that was gained through dominance. But it also had another key element, and that's the climax of humiliation. In the triumphal processions in the time of the empire, not the principate, but the empire, not the republic, but the empire, triumphal processions would begin with all the spoils being going through. They would actually be holding these sticks, and on top of them would be depictions or be names of the places that were destroyed. And then they would be parading in all of the cargo and all the different things, the exotic animals that they had captured from this particular war. And intermixed with all these different spoils was a different type of spoil, and that was people. For they would not kill everyone on the frontier. They would actually bring some of them, hold some of them imprisoned. Even if the triumph procession wasn't granted for another year, they would hold them in prison so they could march them in the triumph procession. We even have evidence of Titus, whenever he's on his way back from Jerusalem into Rome, describing him taking the enemies and making them act out parts of the war during his procession. Killing themselves, executing themselves through fighting as if in the war. Finally, though, once they're going through, the key element, there was two key elements of the whole war, of the whole triumphal procession. Two key. Number one was the emperor. The emperor would come in what was known as a quadriga. It's a chariot with four horses pulling it. Sometimes they would mess around with the horses and they would make it elephants, and there was major problems with that whenever Octavian tried to do that once, whenever the elephants couldn't fit through the gate and they had to, which is a bad omen. But anyway, sometimes they'll change it, but the point was, at the end of the procession would come the incredible depiction of the emperor. Because standing behind would be a slave holding crowns over his head. He'd be even wearing garb. Some people argue that he's even wearing some of the clothing that supposedly, symbolically is referring to Jupiter himself, clothed as a god. But the climax of everything was who was marching in front of the emperor. Right in front of the emperor in the procession would be the key enemy leader. And he'd be bound in chains and be walking in front of the emperor. And what he'd be walking to would be the steps of the temple of Jupiter. He would get to the temple of Jupiter, the emperor would get down off the quadriga, and they would end the triumphal procession to begin a major celebration through the execution of the key enemy leader that had been bound all the way throughout the city, marched all the way across the breadth of the city. In chains. Climax of honor, climax of humiliation. This is what's depicted everywhere. As a matter of fact, let me show you an altar. It's actually important. It's in pieces because I took it. I'm starting on the left end. This is in the museum in Ephesus. Let me draw a picture for you. We've done this before with Ephesus, but it helps if I redo it again. If I'm walking down, and over here on the side I have the Bulatorian. This is one of the major roads. That right down here would be the marketplace with the Library of Celsus right here. You have the Jewish synagogue here, bathhouses over here, public potties right there, houses right here. And right here is just lined with all of these images of deities that they're worshiping. And right here at the apex of the turn in Ephesus was what? Do you remember? The temple to Domitian, in honor of the emperor that is reigning at the time of Revelation, his temple, in which they would worship him every day by taking sacrifices out onto an altar. And as you're walking down the road, you can smell the burning flesh of the animals that are being burned in honor of the emperor as if he were a god. And this was the altar outside of the temple of Domitian. Notice on this far side, we even have sacrifices. Like a bull with the laurel wreaths. Laurel wreaths were something that was put on top of the emperor's head during the triumphal procession to show that he was victorious. And now notice what's on the front. When you go on the left panel, I can't get up high enough. The left panel, the left front panel, you notice what it is. What do you see?
Shields.
Weapons, even right there you see some sort of container that probably would have had some sort of ointment or perfume. You keep going, you see body armors. We'll get to the center panel in a minute. But you continue down here, it's more shields. But these are shields that are foreign shields. And then you see more of that kind of stuff. You see axes. What is this showing? What is this depicting? Spoils of war. Spoils of war. What this altar is a depiction, is a visual depiction of triumphal procession. And notice what's in the very center of this altar dedicated to Domitian at the city of Ephesus. What you see in the center is you see a man standing up holding a mallet. And notice what you see right here. A man wearing foreign garb, sitting down, but look where his arms are. They're bound behind his hands. See, this altar is depicting the climactic moment of the triumphal procession, not when just the spoils of war are coming in, but whenever the key enemy leader is about to be executed. And this is the altar they would be burning sacrifices to in honor of Domitian as the god every single day. What's my argument? I believe that Revelation chapter 27 through 10 is not some weird theological picture of the end of everything. I believe it's a depiction of Satan being released. He must be released so he can participate in God's triumphal procession. Why? Because he's taken out of his prison, but he's not unbound, friends. And what happens? He marches across the breadth of the earth, and he's getting all of his enemies as if they're going to war. But is there ever a war? No. Triumphal processions were very, very prominent in simulating the war that was already won. Because they're not fighting a new war right there in that moment. They're celebrating the fact that the people that are dominant, the sovereign ones, have already won. And they go marching through the city as if the battle was being recreated, and yet we already know the battle's over. I think what's happening is the reason why he's released after the 1,000 years had ended. It's not because he's really going to start another war, because how many times has the war really worked out for him in Revelation so far? This is the third time that a war people are gathering that's never fought. Why? Because the war's already been won. Therefore, we don't need another war in Revelation. What we need is a reminder that the victory has already been won, that all that is left is for God to come in on his chariot, to come in a procession, announcing the victory that everybody recognizes has happened, even Satan. How do I know? He's in chains. And it's something he can never be released of. And this picture would resonate deeply with the people that saw a similar picture every single day in the market. Every single day. Yes?
Firstly, it says after that he must do this for a little while. Mm-hmm. He said that must is like
divine necessity. It's a day.
Do you think a cultural procession like that is contingent on divine necessity? You know?
What do you mean? Help me.
God's trying to recreate that cultural shame.
I don't think he's recreating anything. I think he's using it against them. I think he's using it as a mocking of them. You think you all are leading us in the triumphal procession? Well, Colossians chapter 2, verse 15, what is that talking about? For at the cross, he put them on a spectacle, triumphing over them. The word triumph is the same word that's used in the Greek word for the word that we have in Latin, triumphal procession. Same word. Because the cross was whenever we won the battle. It actually is mocking the enemy. And what I think he's doing is he's taking one of Rome's key images, the puppet of the beasts and of the dragon. And he's saying, we're taking your key enemy leader, the dragon, and we're marching him in our own triumphal procession. Why? Because we won. We've won this battle. Because all of a sudden, think about this literally. At the end of verse 3, they're freaking out. Why must he be released? What's the point of releasing Satan? Why must God do that? It makes no sense unless God says, because I want him to partake in our festivities. He thinks he's marching to a battle? Notice, it's all in the divine passive too. Satan does not free himself. He doesn't escape. What happens? He is released. By whom? Who releases him from prison? The one that has power and authority over him. The one that is celebrating a triumphal procession. And after Satan is destroyed, he's executed. Who's the very next one that comes on the scene? God. The emperor. David Andrew Thomas wrote his PhD dissertation on the triumphal procession, where he argues in Revelation 19 with Jesus riding on the white horse and all the people with white around him is the triumphal procession. But here's my problem with that. Is there triumphal procession imagery there? Yes. But the problem is the two key elements aren't there. The humiliation of the enemy, which I think we find in 27 through 10, and the actual emergence of the emperor. He argues that Jesus is the emperor in 19:11 through 21. But it specifically says he's riding on a white horse, not on a chariot with four white horses. David Onnie even points out the fact that it's very peculiar, even though this seems to reveal some sort of triumphal procession in 19:11 through 21, the fact that he's not riding on a quadriga presents a major problem. However, this is interesting to me as well. Vespasian and Titus, they celebrated a Roman triumph, a triumphal procession, in 70 AD as victory over what? Jerusalem. Actually, it was in like 71, 72, because it was a year after. Point is, the victory that they occurred in 70 occurred a couple years later. Huh. Wouldn't it be significant then for Satan to be in prison for 1,000 years awaiting his triumphal procession that was a victory secured 1,000 years earlier. Anyway, this is what's cool though. Titus and Vespasian are the ones that are actually in the quadriga. But they have another brother. And what's his name? Vespasian is the dad of Titus and Domitian. Where is Domitian in the triumphal procession? He's riding next to the chariot on a single white horse, says Suetonius. The son of a god is riding in a triumphal procession on a single white horse because that's where the family of gods, or that's where the family of the gods ride in triumphal processions, on white horses next to the chariot. And Jesus coming in, the Son of God, is riding on his single white horse, and the enemy is destroyed in 27 through 10, and God's triumphal procession really begins in 21, 1 through 8. See what I mean? The festivities begin in 19, 11 through 21, but they're not culminated in 21, 1 through 8. And Satan plays a key part in that. Otherwise, here's my question. What do we do with the release of Satan? What do we do? There's no Old Testament precedent for this. We've got no real good allusions to help figure this out. We have Gog and Magog. But all Gog and Magog is saying is, this is the last battle. There's nothing after this. It's over. And you're like, oh, it's going to be a battle. There is no battle. Because the battle's already been won. You see what's happening? Allow the imagery to breathe. Allow it to speak. And when it does, it's beautiful. When we don't let it, we just come up with all these weird theological explanations that make no sense on any level whatsoever. So let me finish reading verses 7 through 10, and then, we're over time. We're over time. I love you guys. I'll see you next Wednesday. Your paper's due on Friday. So enjoy the extra 2 days. Make it extra good.